I'm Emma Kenny. Welcome to Bang to Rights, the deep dive crime podcast, which takes you through some of the most heinous crimes the world has ever seen.
Hi guys, today's case was literally deemed too brutal for television. So it goes without saying that what I'm going to talk about today is absolutely horrific. And every case that we do on this channel always has brutality associated with it. That is the nature of crime and indeed murder. However, there are some cases that are stand out when it comes down both to the tragedy, the travesty, and the lack of closure that this case literally examples. The Dardenne family murders are incomprehensibly cruel. And there are lots of reasons why I'm saying that that will become obvious as I move through this video today. It is a case that's been covered in other places, but I wanted to do it mainly because I think the more that we talk about cases that are not solved, the more likely and closer we get to solving them. So let's talk about the Dardenne family. So it's composed of Russell Dardenne, but he was known as Keith. He was 29. His wife was Ruby Dardenne, but her middle name is Elaine, and she too went by her middle name, as Keith did. And they also had a two-year-old son, Peter. So Keith's just 29, Elaine's just 30. They're starting their life as a family, and also she is pregnant at the time of her murder. Keith was originally from Mount Carmel, so about 80 miles away from Ina, whilst Elaine was actually born in Albion, Illinois. Now in 1986, Keith buys a trailer in Ina, Illinois. This is after he'd completed his training to a satisfactory level for his job as a treatment plant operator at the Rend Lake Water Conservancy. It's the district's nearby facility. They then rented land that the trailer sat on from a nearby farming couple. So I imagine it was relatively cheap to do that. And when you are just starting out in your family life, clearly that's going to be very alluring because you want to be able to save money and you want to be able to have a decent lifestyle. Now, it's an extremely small town, Ina. The population back then was only 460 people. So one can imagine you really did know each other. And also, ultimately, it would make you feel relatively safe. When there isn't a big population, you don't feel the same level of threat as you do, for example, in a really busy city. Elaine manages to find a job at an office supply store in Mount Vernon in Jefferson County. And when he wasn't working and she wasn't working, they were very much engaged in the actual church. So they were in the choir at the small Baptist church in the village, and Keith actually sang lead vocals. Elaine played the piano. And I guess that again introduces us to the reality that they enjoyed doing things together, they enjoyed spending time together, they were both clearly talented, and they were individuals who wanted to be part of the community. Because lots of people move places and don't really care about connecting with others from that area. But if you go to church regularly and you start becoming engaged in the church experience, then clearly you're going to build relationships. And that demonstrates that they're obviously sociable as well as being religious, as well as being talented. Now in 1987, Elaine has the really happy news that she's pregnant again. So it's the couple's second child. And they actually decided that they were going to call their little baby either Ian, if it was a boy, or Casey, depending on the baby's sex. Now this prompted Keith and Elaine to really consider the idea about moving to a larger home. Because realistically, you've got two kids, and anybody in the history of having children knows that they don't half make a mess and require space. Genuinely. You have a baby, suddenly your home is at least half plastic. Seriously. They just seem to make kids' toys out of anything that's shiny and plastic. And inevitably, when you love children, they take priority, and that means you're going to bring things in for them to play with. So actually having a trailer and having two children now to contend with, you can understand their motives behind moving to a bigger home. So by late 1987, they'd actually put their mobile home up for sale. But this isn't actually the only reason for the move. So according to Joanne Dardenne, who's Keith's mum, she said the reason that he wanted to move back to Mount Carmel was something that he was so fundamentally committed to that even if he didn't find a job, he was still going to do it. And the reason that he didn't care whether he had a job or otherwise is he really found Ina, the area, to be too violent. He was really concerned about crime. He was quite a true crime buff. He liked reading true crime books. He liked watching programs on it. But it feels like part of that is also because he was very protective over his family and did consider crime to be something that he had to keep an eye on, because arguably he had these children, at least one at this point, the second to arrive, and a wife. And the idea of violence being around him in the area was something that really disturbed him. So he loved the whole true crime area regarding what we like, watching videos, for example, reading books, watching biopics on individuals who've murdered. But it kind of made him really aware. And he kept track on how things were escalating in his locality. So there have been 15 homicides in Jefferson County during the previous 2 years, and it was really disturbing him. And one of Keith's friends actually said that after a 10-year-old girl had been raped and murdered in the area in May 1987, Keith became very, very protective and very concerned, understandably so. It's a horrific idea that a 10-year-old can be raped and murdered in your local area, particularly when your local area is really small. And this protective mechanism was so strong that one night when a young woman came to the home because she needed basically to make a phone call, he didn't let her in. So he wasn't taking any chances. At the end of the day, he didn't know who she was, and he didn't know her motivation, and he didn't want to therefore let her across the boundary. And some people would say that's a massive overreaction, because arguably she could have been in need. Others may think, well, it's a classic ruse, isn't it? You send a girl to a home, and then once she's got entry, if she's got a weapon, she could do whatever she wanted in that moment, including let other people in. And even though it's likely it was completely innocent that she was asking to use the phone, it's a bit odd. I mean, I don't know about you guys. I've never done it. Never just wandered up to somebody's trailer or house and been like, can I just use your phone? I just really need to use your phone. At the end of the day, it is a bit strange. And he erred on the side of caution. And that says something about his mindset. So we can also consider the reality, therefore, that he isn't somebody who takes chances and risks. He knows that bad things happen and he wants to do whatever he can to ensure that nor he nor his family ever come to harm. But of course, I won't be telling this story unless that's exactly what happened to he and his family. So on the 18th of November 1987, Keith Dardine, who is absolutely known for his reliability and punctuality, he doesn't turn up for his shift. And straight away, his colleagues are really concerned because it's out of character. Okay, fair enough, people get ill. But not to even call to inform his supervisor that he couldn't make it, that's strange. So they start ringing his home, trying to get hold of him, and again, doesn't answer the phone. At this point, his supervisor called both of Keith's parents. Now, they were actually divorced and they were living separately, but they lived close enough to each other, so to speak, still in Mount Carmel. So this supervisor, who has the good grace to do that, we have to acknowledge it, don't we? I mean, people are in jobs these days and you might not turn up and people might be annoyed and try to get hold of you, but very often they'll just leave it, you know? 6 months later, you might be found. But not in this case. This supervisor is deeply concerned. So calling Keith's parents to check whether something's gone on, do they need to know about it, or are they there, as opposed to where they're meant to be? But neither knew what had happened to the son, neither. And this again is completely out of character. Now, Don Dardine, that was Keith's father, he then straight away called Jefferson County Sheriff's office and says, listen, I've got a house key. I'm going to drive over to my son's house, but I would really appreciate it if you were to come and meet me and then you can investigate with me. And that's a very sensible thing, because if you are concerned that something terrible might have happened to your child or their family, or maybe there's been an accident, you are going to want the authorities present. So with respect to the deputies, indeed, that's what happens. So the Dardines' home is located between Illinois Route 37 and Illinois Central Railroad tracks, which is just north of the Franklin County line. And this is essentially where they all turn up and meet. And clearly, Keith's father opens the door, the deputies go in with him, and they are, first of all, kind of scrabbling around because they can't see what's happened. It's quite dark, for example, and they're clearly looking for signs of life. And you'd imagine a house with a small child, a three-year-old, there's going to be some noise and there's nothing, it's just silent. And then they make the most horrific discovery. It's beyond belief. So first of all, they find the bodies of Elaine, her little boy Peter, and also the newborn baby girl. All of their bodies have been tucked into the same bed. And the fact that we're talking about a newborn baby when Elaine is only several months pregnant means that she will have given birth due to the trauma that she experienced. But the baby didn't die because of a problematic birth. The baby died because it had been beaten to death. It had been born, and then minutes later, it had been murdered. And she, a beautiful baby girl, never got to experience her life. Never was fed by her mummy. Never got to pass the joy onto everybody else, because the beauty of being born is something that just makes people close to the child so happy. All that was denied. It is inconceivable to me that even the most callous of serial killers, for example, could end a newborn baby's life in that way. Because that baby could not identify the killer, nor could a three-year-old on the whole. So Peter was murdered senselessly. But who could be that callous? So they look straight away and can tell it's murder, because Elaine and Peter had been bound and gagged with duct tape before they were essentially brutalised, beaten to death apparently with Peter's baseball bat. And Peter's baseball bat had been bought by his father earlier that year. It was a present. So the very thing that his daddy had bought him was used to kill him. Elaine suffered a really big blow on the right side of her head, and it actually fractured her skull. So just put that in context. That's one forceful hit. Peter, that poor little boy, just an infant, he had numerous abrasions and contusions, and also his skull was also fractured. As I said, because she was being horribly attacked, Elaine had gone into labour, and then, as I said, that baby was mercilessly murdered too. What's really odd is the killer didn't seem to be in a rush to leave, so they made an attempt to clean up the scene, they tucked the bodies into bed, and the fact that they weren't in a rush, that indicates they weren't expecting to be disturbed. So even though Keith is missing, ultimately, of course, that means that the police are going to suspect that Keith is the perpetrator. What we do know is whoever it is, they think they've got time. And the cleaning up, that could on one level be about trying to minimise forensic detail, of course. On another, it could just say something deeply sinister about the person who's done it, because clearly it's almost making the scene seem less horrifying. If you walk in and there's not blood all over the floors, for example, you're not expecting to find bodies in a bed. So to clean up, even in a rudimentary way, it may be about enticing that person to think everything's okay, and then opening the door and seeing the reality of what's played out, you're totally unprepared. If police turn up to a homicide situation and there is literally a bloodbath, they know what they're looking at, they're ready. But if they walk into a room and on a waterbed there is a family tucked up together in the most grotesquely attacked way possible, you're just not prepared. And also the baby in that situation, you know, to place them all together, it's about staging something that ordinarily, if we were just thinking about that in the context of a mother with her infant child and newborn baby in bed together, that's a beautiful scene, isn't it? It's something that many of us with children will have experienced. But to literally tuck them in, knowing that actually they're bound, they're gagged, they've been brutalised in that way, and to distort such a wholesome scene that it should be, it's almost as if they're enjoying playing with the psychology of the individuals who inevitably find the bodies. Now, as I've said, Keith wasn't present. Also, his car wasn't there. So a red 1981 Plymouth. So the investigators do their ordinary maths, as you would, and think, well, this is family annihilation, pure and simple. He's killed his wife, he's killed his kids, and now he's on the run. So a team of armed police are sent to his mother's house in Mount Carmel, because of course, They want to get him if he's there, because often we see that perpetrators like this will actually try and get some help off a family member, be able to lay low for a while and so on and so forth. But also it can mean that they are on the rampage and they may be heading for a parent's home because they're going to kill them too. But the search doesn't come to anything because Keith isn't guilty of anything at all. In fact, it ends late the following day because they find his body. So a group of hunters are out. They're in a wheat field just over the Franklin County line. It's about a mile away from their mobile home. And Keith hadn't been killed in the way that I've just described befell his family. Instead, he'd been shot 3 times. So once in the skull, he'd been shot on the right side of his face and also his left cheek. But also, they'd chopped his penis off. So he'd been mutilated, and clearly that could have happened before he was indeed killed. So it's very harrowing to imagine that this person had literally demasculated him and his final moments would have been in excruciating pain. His 1981 Plymouth actually got found later on outside the police station in Benton, which was around 11 miles from where the family's mobile home was. And again, that's just telling, isn't it? What does that say about the confidence of the killer? Again, playing with the police. To actually park a murder victim's car outside the police station, it's a very clear indicator of the type of personality that this person has. It's the enjoyment of knowing that just there is the police station. And I'm going to leave this murder victim's car splattered in blood, because it was, right outside. This, when they look at the car, indicates, of course, that Keith had been murdered either in the car or had been mutilated in the car first before being executed. So his final moments must have been absolutely as terrifying as that his family experienced. When the news got out that this had happened, people couldn't believe it. The whole of the community were terrified. In fact, to just be clear on how it impacted on the way that they were dealing with their day-to-day lives, well, they went out and bought a lot of guns. They had security systems installed in their homes. And apparently a lot of the residents would just go about their daily business with shotguns visible in their vehicles. And I have to tell you, we don't have it in the UK where we're just allowed to randomly walk around or drive around with shotguns in our car. But if I had been in a locality that had gone through this and it seemed random and unprovoked, I would likely be driving around with several shotguns, even though I'm not entirely sure how to use one. I would feel better knowing that I had something to use in such a situation. Also, at the school where kids were aware that this had played out, when they'd had basketball games in the evening, students would literally wait inside the school building for their parents to come in. So they would be accompanied back home. So instead of socialising, instead of having fun, instead of being able to walk back home by themselves, that was ended because nobody knew who the killer was or whether they were lurking in the shadows still. Mary Younger, somebody who worked at the town market, said, "Nobody is complacent anymore. Everybody stays aware of their surroundings." And makes perfect sense. The trauma psychologically of not knowing who to trust and not quite knowing what could happen and not feeling safe in your own home. I know that most of us realise that it's a myth of security having your house door or closing your windows. I appreciate that if somebody wants to get in, it isn't too challenging, right? But we tend to believe once we're at home, we are safe. When somebody breaches that boundary and comes in and commits a violent crime, in this case, murders an entire family, it means you are safe nowhere. There is no sanctuary. It can happen to you even in the place that you feel is the safest place in this world. Now, early reports from the police about the Dardenne family's homicide were quite limited. And also some of the information that got out was quite contradictory. And of course, if things aren't linear, it allows people to start creating stories in their minds. So because there isn't a direct press release about what's happening or a press conference that is very specific and sticks to the point and tells the same story, it means that rumours are going to flourish. So the two counties' respective coroners, they even differed on whether Keith had died of a head injury that had been inflicted by being dragged from a car or that he was shot. And they are pretty distinct, aren't they? When it comes down to it, how can one coroner think maybe he was dragged along from a car and that's how he died, or he was shot and that's how he died? Anyway, it means that people start to create all these ideas of what could have happened. Also, those circumstances under which Elaine gave birth, because she could have been dead when she gave birth, or she could have been giving birth as she was murdered, or it could have happened before she was murdered. So when that little girl was born, they didn't know whether she'd been ripped essentially from her mother's womb, because that's what people were starting to say. Obviously, what had happened is she'd gone into traumatic labour because of the horror that was happening, no matter whether that happened before death or just after death. But nobody ripped the baby from her womb. But that's what people start to embellish these tales with. And because those rumours are spreading, and also because obviously Keith had his genitals mutilated, people start thinking this is satanic, that a group of Satanists have been active in the area and they've gone ahead and performed this ritual sacrifice on the family. Also, bear in mind, there had been quite a lot of crimes in the area, so there became this speculation, along with three other local unsolved murders, that there was likely a regional serial killer. So you've got serial killers, you've got evil devil-worshipping cult, you've got lots of people concerned about the possibilities of this kind of thing happening again to them. And like I said, human beings, we want answers. And if we don't get answers, we'll often ask lots of questions and get answers from people who don't necessarily know anything about it. But because we know them and trust them, we start believing it. So it amplifies the absolute terror in the local community. And Dr. Richard Garrettson, so he was a family physician, he doubled as the Jefferson County coroner. He told the St. Louis Post-Dispatch that many of his patients talked to him about the case and how it had disturbed them. Yes, that makes sense. It's horrifically disturbing, isn't it? And one man who said he only lived half a mile from the Dardenne's home told that doctor that he was having lots of difficulty sleeping, he'd lost 14 pounds due to stress. The Dardenne's landlord's daughter said to her parents that for years, she actually kept her bedroom light on and read all night out of fear. Because, like I said, the bogeyman's out there and it's real for all these individuals and nobody's coming forward with answers. And Robert Lewis, who's the Franklin County coroner, he felt that much of the fear was unjustified. He said, "I don't think there is a rational basis for the near hysteria. The people are frightening each other. Just going to throw it out there, Robert. We're just going to have a little bit of a conversation. I think it was because an entire family had been murdered horribly. I mean, not just shot. Not in a scenario where somebody just executes. That would still not be okay. That would still be terrible. But somebody who took time killing and is so malevolent that they actually took them up in bed. Oh, and they murdered a baby that had just been born. Oh, and they mutilated Keith's genitals and then killed him. I'm just thinking that, like, if you're going to be a little bit scared, you're going to be scared of those kind of things. It doesn't really feel that dramatic, Robert. It feels contextual. I don't know about you, but I don't imagine that Robert's the most touchy-feely kind of doctor in a compassionate way, is he? You'd walk in and be like, "I'm feeling really depressed," and he'd be like, "Just get a life." That kind of doctor, you know? I don't think there's a rational basis for this hysteria. Why? Why? What? Where are you on the emotional rock level, Robert? But anyway, he thinks everybody's going over the top. And apparently people were so afraid that if someone ran out of petrol in the county, they wouldn't go and actually ask for help from any of the nearby houses because they thought could be a serial killer there. But they would, in fact, walk to the nearest highway and hitchhike. Now, I am with Robert on this one. That's a little bit hysterical because you're probably more likely just going to throw it out there, to get picked up by a serial killer on a highway hitchhiking than you are just knocking on a neighbourhood door if you've run out of petrol or needed some help. Seriously. But like I said, people are not trusting the neighbours. And that's the fallout and ramifications of these kind of traumatic killings. Because if you don't know who, then it could be anybody. And if it can be anybody, who on earth do you trust? The police are desperate, of course, to bring this killer to justice. And local police stations join forces with the Illinois State Police to investigate the case. And a total of 30 detectives worked full-time following leads and interviewing over 100 people. So they put resources into this, but nothing proved fruitful. Now, there was a guy taken into custody early in the investigation, but he was released after he was questioned. Also, a co-worker of Keith, whom apparently had an argument with, he was brought in, but also cleared. You kind of think to yourself, sorry? You want me to come in for questioning because of what? Well, you had an argument with Keith. I have had an argument with Keith, you're correct. Well, if you have had an argument with Keith, you may have decided to annihilate his family. Have you thought about going and speaking to Dr. Robert? Because he'll tell you you're being a bit dramatic there. Did you kill the entire family because you had an argument with Keith? No, I didn't. I have regular arguments with my wife. She's still breathing. Sometimes I do think that it might be more pleasant if she wasn't, but only when I'm very much involved in conflict. The rest of the time, I don't kill her. You know, I get it. You're looking for a chain of causation. Somebody's had a row with you. Maybe they'd want to kill you. But why would you want to kill somebody's entire family? I mean, that is a whole next level, isn't it? Also, when they're asking questions around and speaking to the people that they're speaking to about the couple, people just have nothing bad to say about them at all. Everybody thinks really well of this family. Now, they found a small amount of marijuana in the actual trailer, but nothing to suggest they're involved in drugs or dealing. And some police thought it just didn't fit with the typology of victim they were. They were churchgoers. They were very, very organised. They were people who were always where they were meant to be at the time they said they were going to be it. There was nothing loose living about them. And they thought that maybe the marijuana didn't belong to them. Maybe it had been left behind by the killers or killer. The autopsies as well kind of validated this. So there was no drugs or alcohol in any of the victims. Of course, you wouldn't imagine that in the baby or the little infant. But if you were taking drugs or you were drinking alcohol as adults, they would know. And there wasn't anything there. When it came down to deciding when and what time the actual Dardines had died, the pathologist put all of their murders down at within an hour of one another. So Elaine, Peter and little baby Casey had been killed 12 hours at least before their bodies were found. And Keith had been dead for 24 to 36 hours when he was found. So this did make it slightly harder to determine how the crime had been committed. Keith's body had been found away from the trailer. So he may have been killed at that location rather than with his family. And at the trailer, the killer or killers had taken the time to not only tuck Elaine's body into bed along with the children's bodies, but also to rudimentarily clean up the scene. So that suggests that there's no urgency to leave. It also, in my opinion, suggests that maybe Keith had been removed first and the family had been under threat of not telling anybody or something terrible would have happened to Keith. And then once Keith had been dealt with, the killer had returned because their main issue was to have some time with the rest of the family. So that could also be a reason as to why they were at separate locations. And the amount of effort that had been made, that led the police to think, you know what, it was likely that this crime took place at night. So the trailer was on Route 37, which is a busy state highway, but you could also see that trailer, at least back then, from Interstate 27, which is about 610 metres to the west. It's been obstructed now, that view, by the construction of a men's prison, Big Muddy River Correctional Centre, in fact. So the police put this together in a way that at least makes some sense for them. They can't understand why it's happened, but they think they have a kind of timeline around when it happened. So, of course, they're looking at motive. Because when you think about an entire family being annihilated, you've got to think that somebody potentially has a real issue with them. But like I've said, everybody loves this family. And figuring out what the motive is probably the most challenging thing the police have to do. So there's no evidence of forced entry. The back door had actually been left open. Lying in plain view was cash. There was a VCR. There was a video camera. None of them had been stolen. Also, no member of the family had been raped or sexually assaulted. But I would say mutilating somebody's genitals is sexual assault. Like I said, it's not considered it when I do the research in this area. For some reason, they don't look at it as a sexual assault. I personally think if somebody has literally had their penis removed, that's a sexual motive, without a doubt. Demasculating somebody in that way, so physically, as well as annihilating their family. If you could ever do the worst thing to a man, just contextualize that for a moment psychologically. If you're in a scenario where, as a male, and I understand women would happily die for their family, it goes without saying, I get it. But I'm just going to go into some more gender stereotypical roles for a moment. Don't have to agree with me on it. Don't have to agree with me on it. But personally, I feel that the average man, there'll be exceptions, but the average man feels they have a duty to protect the ones they love. And I feel that they consider themselves a ward of that protection. So when you think about being the husband in this situation, and we're just talking about a heterosexual, straight family with two children, kind of the typical dynamics, right? That man is going to look at his wife and child and feel responsible for their safety. Even if he's not got the capacity to protect them, above everything else, he would wish to. Imagine being so dominating and sadistic as a killer that you know the ultimate agony that would happen for a man is to not just witness you brutalizing and murdering the thing that he wishes to protect more than any other thing in the world, but after that's happened, you literally cut off his penis. You take the very thing that created something that's just been destroyed in front of him. If ever you wanted to psychologically and physically destroy somebody, that'd be a very powerful way to do it. And if you have, for example, the nature of a serial killer, oh, imagine that. Imagine the allure of just seeing the absolute terror, horror, devastation as you literally kill each of his most precious possessions, something that he would die for. And whilst I appreciate people aren't objects, it's still how you feel. They belong to me, they're mine. And to have that taken from you in such a violent, sadistic fashion, and then while you already feel demasculated because you haven't been able to do anything to help them, they've cut your penis off. Oh, I just think that that's a really powerful, sadistic way of operating. And like I said, I can't say that happened. I'm saying that if we step into the mindset of somebody, for example, a serial killer, that would genuinely be effective. It also reminds me of things like mafia killings, the literal take no prisoners killings. That I am going to show you exactly what happens when you do A, B, or C to me. It's going to be a horrific retaliation. And that isn't because I think that this family had any connections in that way. I'm saying that's the level that this kind of humiliation as well as murder is used, because it's about stripping away everything that person holds dear and also their power. And then finally, the very thing that made them a man, in this case, his penis. Now, please start to go through the family dynamics, because obviously they want to look at whether somebody's got some kind of issue with the family. They find no evidence of extramarital affairs. So Keith and Elaine are both faithful to each other. This means that somebody hasn't come within a jealous rage and taken it out on them. Also, a stack of papers with sports scores was found in the house, and that led police to think, oh, maybe Keith's got a bit of a gambling issue. Maybe he's got some gambling debts, and so somebody is here to take retribution on them. But again, that doesn't really stack up, does it? Even if he was in great debt, which he wasn't, the truth is, why would you kill somebody? Because it's a surefire way never to get paid. isn't it? It's a surefire way never to get paid. And Joanne Dardeen, Keith's mother, she said, listen, my son was so frugal that he literally raised money for his son's college fund by reselling 50-cent drink cans at work for a small profit. So this is not a man who is going out and literally losing his fortune when he cares deeply about saving his fortune. Detective Mike Anthis, he said, it feels like we've got all the pieces of the puzzle. We just have to put them in the right order. And that must be deeply frustrating because for law enforcement, you're talking about the worst of the worst crimes here and they still haven't found who's responsible. The Franklin County coroner, Robert Lewis, he actually felt that the motive for this crime was personal. So he didn't believe the Dardeens were randomly chosen. Probably why he felt that people shouldn't be hysterical. You don't need to worry. If you haven't annoyed whoever this is, then they're not going to kill you because it's personal. That's probably why he was giving that message out. But he didn't believe the Dardeens were randomly chosen. He said, I believe it was a very personal, deliberate thing. But again, does it sound like a very personal, deliberate thing? Well, as I said, we're talking about the mafia. Sure, it could. But if we're not, it sounds to me like it has the hallmarks of a serial killer. I mean, you've annihilated a family in the most grotesque of ways and you've incited as much terror as possible. And we're talking about the murder and brutalization of babies and toddlers. That doesn't necessarily sound personal. It sounds so deviant, so sadistic, that it takes an individual with the dark triad of traits to ever consider such an action. A police expert on cults, they came in because obviously people were talking about satanic panic, and they told the newspapers that the rumour that Satanists were responsible just wasn't true. And the reason that expert said that is, yes, these kind of groups, who are very rare, they would kill, but they'd really mutilate the bodies far more extensively. Often they'd harvest organs, and it would be really important for them to leave symbols. So they'd light candles, for example, or they'd draw pentagrams. Something that indicated, we were here, we are doing this because we are Satanists. But none of that had actually been found at the Dardeen's trailer. I understand why people were considering that potentially it could be satanic, because you're thinking about a baby being murdered in that way and human ritual sacrifice. But this seemed to go against what had been seen in other satanic murders. Police did allow for the possibility that while the Dardeens were chosen on purpose, it could have been a case of mistaken identity. So they're thinking, well, this is such a horrific kind of murder. It's telling a story. Maybe it's being used to inform other people who were involved in A, B or C that this will happen to them too if they don't follow D and F. But that there had been a mistake and the Dardeens had done nothing wrong and a person had found them doing a hit job, giving this message out, but really had hit the wrong family, so had made a mistake. But that's a bit of a big mistake to make, isn't it? With respect. And if you've gone to the trouble of hiring somebody who's willing to go and do that for you, one would imagine they would have had the sophistication to case the joint, to figure out exactly who was there, to know the identity of that individual. And if you break in and you have time to actually have some kind of conversation with those individuals, for example, check their ID, or be in a scenario where you're being told by them, we're not these people, yeah, it wouldn't be great that you'd broken in, but would you carry on and kill the entire family, including the baby, if you knew, oh, I'm at the wrong address? Just seems a little bit extreme as far as I'm concerned. Now, Keith's mother later said that she thought about other motives. She said, I think someone wanted Keith to sell drugs and he refused, or there's a possibility someone liked Elaine and she wouldn't accept the advances and he just took his rage out on both of them. She said, we just don't know. Again, I think it's strange, the idea that somebody would murder an entire family because Keith wouldn't agree to selling drugs. That doesn't necessarily play out when you consider it, because why would you kill an entire innocent family because they're not going to buy into the game of dealing? It just doesn't play out, not at least in my mind, and certainly with the research I've done on cases, I genuinely can't see that connection. Also, why would somebody kill the entire family and murder Elaine because she wasn't into them? It's just so extreme. It's just enormously extreme. So there are all these ideas as to why they've been murdered, but police settle on their most plausible theory, in their minds at least, that the killer gained entry to the home, at some point left the trailer with Keith and murdered him, and then returned to the home to eliminate the witnesses. Like I said, I think I would disagree with that, genuinely. I think they murdered his family in front of him and then killed him. That's just my impression from this research. They don't get anywhere with this case. It just goes cold. They exhaust all their leads, and of course there's a time frame, they have to start working on other cases. Two FBI profilers actually came to the area to review the evidence. They wanted to make some suggestions, but ultimately when they looked at it, it just seemed so random and it didn't add up that they couldn't give any answers. But then think about it. We see this constantly. It's awful to acknowledge that serial killers operate in a way where they are prepared and they will execute individuals without any conscience, and it doesn't seem to make sense because serial killers don't make sense. Think about Israel Keyes, an individual who is operating very effectively, wiping out couples and individuals at will whenever he fancied, and doing it very effectively. It didn't make sense. None of the people were in any way, shape or form responsible for his murders, but he knew what he was doing. I've done a video on Israel Keyes. It evidences what I'm just talking about right now. The randomness is key. Of course it is. If you plan to kill, you don't want to plan to kill people that you know, because there'll be a link. But anyway, there are all these different ideas around who could have done it and why they might have done it. Keyes' mother, she did a really good job, because the case has gone cold. So her son's family were wiped out and they haven't brought anybody to justice. So she's constantly speaking to the press, trying to get them to be interested. Throughout the 90s, she's regularly calling Detective Mike Anthes, who'd been the only detective still assigned to the case at that point, just trying to offer possible leads, asking for any new information that he could share. Apparently they remained friends even after he retired. So she wouldn't let it go. And Joanne gathered 3,000 signatures from the area's residents for a petition to the Oprah Winfrey Show, asking producers to do a segment on the murder of her son and his family. And they were like, no, it's just too brutal for daytime television, which makes no sense whatsoever, because the whole premise that we want it on daytime television is because it is brutal, because we want to get the person who brutalized them. I mean, I get it. People think that daytime television should be shiny and happy, but that's not true anymore. Watch Dr. Phil, for example. And also, Oprah covers a whole heap of stuff that I wouldn't say is particularly palatable to watch, but they didn't want to do it. And I think that's a real shame, because you don't have to go into the gory details, do you, to actually highlight this horror. Also, America's Most Wanted had a similar reaction. So the worst crimes that they're meant to cover are on America's Most Wanted, but they were like, no, it's a little bit too brutal for us. Aren't you, like, literally dealing with the most dangerous criminals? Yeah, but it's just, it's too brutal. We like to have a spectrum of brutal, and we get to this point of brutal, but then yours is just a little bit too far past that point of brutal, so no. I mean, they did relent, and in the end, in 1998, the producers did allow a segment on it, but it didn't generate any new leads. And again, if you are going to kill, kill randomly, because it makes no sense. Unless you've left evidence and DNA, etc., the likelihood is you can get away with it. Not just once, not just twice, many times, which we see constantly where serial killers are concerned. Now, I know, I appreciate, I have no evidence to say it's definitely a serial killer, and I'll note that at this point. I'm just saying, with my research and experience, that's what I think this was. Now, eventually the police did start to think maybe it was a serial killer, and they were briefly interested in Angel Maturino Resendez. He was known at this point by his alias Rafael Resendez Ramirez, and he did eventually surrender to authorities in Texas in 1999, which meant that they were able to speak to him. So Resendez was a Mexican serial killer. He'd been suspected in as many as 23 murders across the US and Mexico during the 1990s. Some of those killings and assaults also involved sexual assaults. Now, after every single one of his murders, he'd basically linger in the homes, and mainly they believe that's because he just wanted to eat the food. He killed at least 15 people, and he killed them with things like rocks, a pickaxe, other blunt objects, mainly in the homes. And he ended up earning the nickname the Railroad Killer because he did often travel around the country by hopping freight trains, choosing victims that basically lived in close proximity to train tracks, and obviously the Dardenes did. And I guess this would make sense when you look at it on the surface, because he can get to the house, he can kill, he can spend some time cleaning and eating, and then get back to the train and hop back on the next one that was available. But some aspects of Resendez's crimes didn't align. So he tended to steal things from the home. So he'd stole jewellery, he stole other items, and he'd give it to his wife and his mother. You know, here is a present for you. Oh, it's a very nice ring. Yes, it is. Why is this ring a little bit sticky? Don't worry, just go and clean it and pop it on. But anyway, that's what he did. So he was taking mementos and he was enjoying watching his mother and wife actually wear them. So he also would take sentimental items. He'd have a tendency to lay out the victims' driver's licenses to learn about their lives. How macabre is that? But police were never able to actually connect him to the Dardenne family massacre. But nonetheless, it makes sense as to why they looked at him, particularly the blunt force injuries that the family experienced. But then we get the confession of Tommy Lynn Sells. So he's a serial killer, a Texas serial killer, in fact, that essentially brought himself to the attention of the police in Illinois by saying he did the killings I've covered today. Now, on the last day of 1999, Tommy Lynn Sells cut the throats of two girls as they slept in their homes near Del Rio, Texas. His victims were Kayleen Harris, she was 13, and Crystal Searles, who was 10. Searles, thank God, survived the attack. And because of that, the police were able to create a composite sketch of the killer, and that allowed the authorities to track down Sells. She did a really good job. So he was eventually convicted and sentenced to death. Now, whilst he was awaiting trial for his first murder charge, Sells began confessing to other murders he'd committed whilst he was drifting around the country, sometimes by hopping freight trains as well. So one of the confessions is about the Dardenne family. Sells said that he didn't actually remember the details of all the crimes that he committed. He just said he thought that that was a coping mechanism from the sexual abuse he endured as a child. So he's basically saying he disassociated. So he acted in certain ways that were highly traumatizing for other people, but it stemmed from trauma himself. And therefore he didn't store the memories to some degree, or there was a protective mechanism in his brain which prevented him from remembering. Now bear in mind, in the mid 1980s, Sells was living near St. Louis. It's about 90 miles northwest of Jefferson County. So Sells would tell the police that when he was killing, the main objective he had was theft. So he'd be hitchhiking with truckers, or he'd be hopping on freight trains, and he wouldn't necessarily have any destination in mind. He said, anywhere a ride was going, I was heading that way. Might be Illinois today, Oklahoma tomorrow. And so this is how he said he became familiar with the Ina area. Now on one trip, this is through Jefferson County in 1987, Sells said that he'd met Keith at a truck stop near Mount Vernon. But also at another time, he tells that he'd met him at a local billiards room. But in both versions, he says Keith invited Sells home for dinner, which immediately we're all thinking, hang on, is that the same Keith who wouldn't let a girl in who knocked on the door and needed to use the phone? But it's by the by, let's just carry on down this road. So after this meal, Sells is apparently just planning on leaving, even though in all other situations he would steal and often kill, but on this occasion he was just leaving. And apparently at this point, Keith angers him by sexually propositioning him, even though Keith had never been of that persuasion or ever acted in this way before. Apparently with Sells, he was so irresistible that Keith decided he'd potentially change his sexuality. Now, in one account, he also said this story switched a little bit because now it's a threesome he was invited to with him and Elaine. Of course, Elaine would feel like that. At 7 months pregnant, who isn't just hoping to swing and share their body with a random stranger, particularly one as alluring as Sells, but is throwing these ideas in. And to be fair, the disrespecting and dehumanising of Elaine and Keith is disgusting because it's reputational damage, that kind of stuff, isn't it? At the end of the day, she was a loving, doting parent. She was about to give birth to another child. They were really happy together. And here we have this horrible serial killer saying, oh, well, actually, they just wanted to have some really illicit sex with me. He said he was so offended by this that he literally forced Keith at gunpoint to drive where his body was found. He killed him, he mutilated him, and then apparently he returned to the trailer to kill Elaine and Peter because apparently they were witnesses, so they needed to die. He said, I was just so pissed off that I took it to the maximum limit. Rage don't have a stop button. He said this explained why he killed the newborn baby as well. But again, this doesn't really make sense because at the end of the day, why would he chance leaving the family there and alive and removing Keith, taking time to kill him, and then returning back to bludgeon them all to death? It's just not stacking up. Now, in a third version of the story, because why not? Why not have 150 versions of the story? But in a third version of the story, Sells changes this story, this time entirely. So this time he says he got off a freight train, which he'd hopped near Ina. Then he'd seen the Dardeen trailer with its for sale sign. And so he thought, you know what? For sale sign, knock on. They'll be like, yeah, sure, come in. Look around my nice trailer that you might buy. And then he'd just kill everyone. So that was his sign for an opportunity for murder, basically. So he said then he held back, drank a few beers, waited for the right time. Because again, I mean, who isn't going to invite a drunk man in? You want to buy my trailer? You're slightly inebriated. Maybe I'll be able to get you to give me a good price. Doesn't make sense again. But anyway, this is what he says. He was drinking beer, waiting for the right time. Then he knocked on the door and told Keith that he was really interested in buying the trailer. At this point, he overpowered him, made Keith bind and gag his son and wife with duct tape and forced him to drive his car to the nearby field at gunpoint where he cut Keith's penis off, telling him he was going to take it back to Elaine. He then shot Keith and left his castrated penis with him. At the trailer, he then raped Elaine, then beat Peter, Elaine, and the newborn to death. And after cleaning up, he then drove Keith's car to Benton, parking outside the police station. There are a lot of doubts about the legitimacy of his confession. And I understand why. Because this is somebody who keeps changing his story. And there was a lot of information that was available in the press about this case. So if you want to falsely confess, you will be able to piece together a story that seems to be based in truth. So when he confessed, in spite of changing his story like 150,000 times, some investigators genuinely believe that when he was executed in 2014, the Dardeens got justice as well. Even though he never actually got charged with the murders, allegedly some say that he still remains the number one suspect. And Sheriff Robert Mulch, he was somebody who actually interviewed Sells, he said that the reason that he believes that he was guilty was that he revealed certain details that only the killer could have known. So yes, the public were given a lot of details about this crime, but there were elements that were kept back and he knew some of those elements. But he's changed his story so many times. And I guess when you're being interviewed by the police, even though the police may never think that they're giving away certain details, things can slip out. You can attach to certain things that somebody's saying and build pictures. And it could be that Sells did that as well. He changed his story so many times. How do we know whether he was telling the truth or otherwise? Other investigators don't believe that he was responsible. They feel that while Sells' account to some degree is consistent, it tends to be spattered with facts of the case that were known. So most of what he told the authorities had been reported publicly. And when Sells was actually asked about information that had been withheld from the media, he was apparently a lot less reliable. So his claim about which seat of Keith's car he was shot in is contradicted by the physical evidence. When asked how Elaine's body was positioned, firstly, he answered it incorrectly. Then he guessed correctly, but that could just have been a lucky guess. And in a 2010 interview, Sells stated, I know people got the doubts. They say there's no physical evidence tying me to the Dardeens. But there wasn't for any of the murders because they weren't looking for me. I moved. I was always a transient. So he's confidently stating, of course he didn't have any evidence because I didn't leave any. and you weren't looking for me because I was never in one area long enough to become a suspect. Texas police did confirm that Sells was indeed responsible for 22 murders, but they felt that he was staking claim to other murders on purpose and that he was consciously imitating another Texas serial killer, a guy called Henry Lee Lucas, who was known as the Confession Killer. And they believe he was doing this to try to avoid the death penalty. Because if you can say, oh, well, I am going to clear up more crimes, and if I go ahead and keep telling you that I've killed A, B, and C and scooping up all of these other crimes that you need to solve, then you might get some grace from the judicial system. They may think of you more kindly, maybe even vacate your death penalty, so to speak. But at least if you're talking to them, the death penalty date is likely to be put back because you're giving them more information that they want. So because he was doing this, police in Illinois actually wanted to take him to Ina to see whether he did know the area like he suggested he did, so whether he could point out the areas relevant to the crime. And Sells did actually say, look, I'll take you to the missing evidence, but Texas law doesn't allow prisoners on death row to be taken out of state, and authorities were basically unwilling to make an exception, which is bizarre. I mean, just going to throw it out there. How power hungry are you and how power needy are you if you're just not going to let somebody who could essentially prove that they are the killer in an unsolved crime, and you're not going to let them go and do it because it's not allowed out of the state of Texas? You know, maybe just be a bit lenient with their laws when it brings closure to a family. Illinois declined to file murder charges on Sells because, unfortunately, no matter whether he was confessing or otherwise, they had a lack of sufficient evidence. They wouldn't have met the bar. And that's really sad, because if he is responsible, then he should have his name associated and the family should be given a level of closure over this. And doubts about Sells' confession isn't just limited to local law enforcement. Friends and family have issues with some of his claims. So first of all, they know that there's no way Keith would have invited somebody to dinner with his family. Bear in mind, the guy was moving because he was scared about the increase in killings in the local area. And a family friend said, as I did earlier, he wouldn't let a young girl in to use the phone. He wouldn't let a 22-year-old man in. And they also said that the idea that Keith made a sexual advance on him was ridiculous. Keith wasn't interested in other men. Police didn't find any corroborating evidence that suggested that was the case. And detectives who actually interviewed Sells said that if he did kill the Dardines, he basically invented that detail to make the crime seem more justified. He was saying, oh, well, I didn't just cold-bloodedly murder this entire family. I did it because I was a victim of Keith's inappropriate sexual advances. Also, in confessing to other crimes, he often included similar stories to make it seem like he was provoked to anger by his victims. So this was something that just was a constant in the way that he dealt with admitting the crimes. He'd just add another layer where somehow he acted in a reaction to somebody's advances. Now, it comes to Keith's mother. In 2000, when Sells confessed, she felt he was responsible. In fact, she told the Chicago Tribune that she was certain that was the case. And she felt like if she could talk to him, it would help her to mop up basically any lingering doubts. She said, I've always wanted to know every detail. Some people might think that's gory, but when someone does something to my family, I want to know why. I understand that. It's why family members will often sit through the most traumatic details in courts. They don't want to know the detail for any other reason that they can't have any missing jigsaw pieces. To lose somebody traumatically, to have a child stolen by murder, to know that your loved ones were raped and violated and tortured before death, it's horrific. But you need to understand what happened so you have no questions. And so I understand fully why Keith's mother feels this way. And Keith's mother, still 7 years later, on the 20th anniversary of the Dardine massacre and the year after Sells' initial execution date had been stayed, so a federal appeals court considered his mental state, Joanne said she was 99% sure and again wanted to talk to him. And in his 2010 interview, Sells was actually sceptical of what that conversation could accomplish. So it wasn't that he was against speaking to her, it's just he didn't know what he could tell her that would help. He said, if Joanne wants to come and talk to me, if she wants to come here and talk to me, scream at me, yell, kick me, hit me, she should have that right. He also said that no apology could give her closure. Said, sorry ain't going to cut it, so what is there to say? I could say sorry every day of the rest of my life. It's not going to stop her pain. And one thing I do know about pain is it doesn't go away. Anyway, in spite of the fact that he would have talked to her and that she apparently wanted to speak to him, the two never did talk. By the time of Sel's execution, though, Joanne had started thinking he wasn't actually the individual who killed her family. So even though she had for a period of time had that firm conviction, that firm belief, this is the guy, he's taken responsibility, he's given information over, it fits the fact that he is a serial killer and it certainly looks like my child and his family were murdered by a serial killer. Over the years, she thought to herself, you know, as much as he said, as much as he suggested he was the one who did it, I'm not buying it. And the reason for that is, she said, the things he said don't match up with what I know about Keith. And it's terrifying to think that this family was wiped out in this way and they don't have the answers. The Dardeen case, right up until now, it remains unsolved. And the gun that was used to kill Keith Dardeen, it's never been recovered. Or if it has, it's not been disclosed in the public domain anyway. Elaine also wasn't sexually assaulted, and obviously that's going to disprove one version of Sel's confession. Although that interests me because I appreciate that they, as forensic examiners, can see if a violent sexual assault has occurred. But she gave birth to a baby. I'm just not entirely convinced that you would be able to tell if a woman had been sexually assaulted when she went through a traumatic labour. It's just the musings as I was researching that came to mind. How would they really be able to tell? I mean, it's quite a traumatic experience giving birth to a baby, even a premature baby. There can be real tearing, there can be abrasions as the baby comes out, particularly if you're thinking about it happening in such a traumatic way. So I'm not sure whether they could 100% state that she wasn't violated. Also, the fact that he was violated in such a grotesque way. Keith was literally emasculated physically. He had his penis taken off. So I would say there's definitely a sexual motive there. And the sadistic pleasure of a woman being forced into premature labour and giving birth to a baby that has then also beaten to death. If you think about sexual sadism and sadism as the same spectrum, then you don't get more sexually sadistic and more sadistic than this, per se. It's literally the most brutal crime one can even conceive of. And if you are a serial killer, that will give you a rush like no other. To be a serial killer in this context, where you have not only control over a living family and their demise, but you forcibly create a situation where a baby is born and then you kill it. Even in their world of fantasy, they couldn't imagine something so macabre. But it's perfect for a killer of that ilk. Because imagine the terror. Imagine knowing the horror you've provoked to such a degree that that woman gives birth, and then the pleasure that killer has in also taking that baby's life. Whilst it sounds like something out of a horrific mafia movie, this really did occur. Dardeen family were wiped out by somebody so prolific in their appetite, so insatiable in fact in their appetite to kill, that they murdered this family in just the most barbaric of fashions. I don't know if we'll ever find out who killed the Dardeens. I do hope to God they've kept as much forensic evidence, no matter what it is, and that they retest it again and again and again. Maybe it was Sel's, maybe it wasn't Sel's, but personally, it's got the hallmarks of a serial killer every day of the week.
That's it for Bang to Rights today. Join me for the next episode. See you then. Be safe.